this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything? Look at this trove, treasures untold. How many wonders can one cavern hold? Looking around here, you think, sure, she's got everything.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
But who cares? No big deal. I want more.
Place to Be Nation pop experience. How are you on this lovely evening? Of course, you are here with me, and if you don't know who I am Miranda Berthold, and I have two wonderful co-hosts here this evening to help me discuss our amazing journey. It is the catalog through Disney. So since I messed up the time zones this evening, as one usually does, I'll go ahead and introduce the man that tried to get me on the right track, Mr. Andy Atherton.
Oh, Miranda, it's always an adventure with you, but it's always a pleasure. Mm-hmm. It's great to be here. I'm excited because we are at the Renaissance, I think we've been talking about, the second Renaissance. We kind of had to get through, so to speak, some of the other movies that are not as high up on
Known, less popular maybe.
Yeah, lesser known. But you know, this is a movie that I've seen so many times, especially having a daughter who did watch this with me before going back to school. So I did get that. And yeah, it's a lot of fun to talk about, and I'm very excited to travel under the sea.
Yes. And while we're going under the sea, let's go to the gentleman that is part of our tripod here that never complains about me being late to anything, and that's our good friend Steve. Steve, how you doing over there?
I am doing good, and you know, how can we complain about lateness? I mean, you know, when we're traveling across, you know, we're halfway around the world. I mean,
three time zones.
You gotta deal with that. You gotta deal with that sometimes. But yes, I am extremely excited. I got my my Dinglehopper and my Snarfblatt and ready to take this journey under the sea and begin what I'm sure, you know, a lot of people would probably say, including all of us, the greatest period in Disney cinema history.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. Yeah. So from all of us up where they walk and up where they run, let's get down with the Little Mermaid. So, guys, this is classified as a musical comedy fantasy. I would agree with all of those things, would you not?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. So here we are in 1989, and the runtime, because we usually give you guys that, is 83 minutes, so still not too bad. We're still there in some decent range, keeping kids' attention movies. And this is what number are we on? Because honestly, my brain just went dead. What number? Older are we here?
28.
I remember? 28. Oh, so the 28th installment. This movie came out in November 17th of 1989, and then it actually returned to theaters in 1997. And it is, as the guys have both mentioned, it is considered the first to be released during the Renaissance. And it is loosely based, if you have ever read the original story of The Little Mermaid, I highly recommend you do, but it is loosely based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale of the same name. And it also kind of marked Disneyland's 35th anniversary 1 year after it released. So there was a lot going on with this that kind of helped boom and bring back everything within Disney together. So overall, before we kind of get into, like, I think most everyone really understands or knows rather about the plot and everything, and we will talk about that. But before we get started, I want to know a question that you ask us a lot, Andy, when you're hosting, is when's the first time you watched this, and do you have any like real strong connections to this movie? So Andy, you go first, since you usually ask Steve and I that, like, when do you remember the first time seeing it, and do you have, I mean, obviously you do have a daughter that I know she enjoys this movie, but like, Do you have a strong like memory that it ties this movie? Because we are starting to reach to where a lot of us are going to be like, I remember blah, blah, blah.
Well, I don't think I saw this in theaters because I was like 16 or 17 when it came out and I hadn't hit my Disney love yet. Mm-hmm. Really, I'd always liked Disney, but I wasn't there yet in my life. I remember though, there was a girl that I was friends with in college freshman year and she loved the movie. And whenever we had like nothing to do, I would like, you know, we would see each other or whatever, literally get across from us in the dorm on the other side of the hallway. And I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, I'll watch a Little Mermaid. I'm like, all right. And then she would literally sing all those words to it. It was fun. And then I got to, I started really watching this a bit more once, Jessica was born. Because a little girl with that, and she loves the movie too. She was giggling the whole time. We were watching this right before she went back to school. So I have a lot of fond memories of this movie. And as you guys know, something that we haven't talked about on this show, and maybe we could do maybe a pod blast about, is the underwater sequence in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, or the whole island in Naboo between the lagoon and the above ground. And this is kind of like a full-length feature of what they did there, and which I love, and I did share with you guys. I just got a pin. It's very rare, like when they announce these D23 member exclusives, that you actually get your hands on one of them.
Yeah,
they only make like a certain amount, but I did get it, so it was a little Christmas present to me. But yeah, no, I've had this circled, not just because it's a great movie, also because of what we talk about, what it's going to, where we are now in terms of this pod. So,
what it leads to, basically.
Very excited about this.
Cool. Steve, do you remember the first time you watched it? And do you have any like strong memories or connections tied to it?
Well, so I was 4 years old when it came out, so I definitely know I didn't see it in theaters, but it was on a video because I did have it on video. Obviously, having a younger sister, we got a lot of the films with the princesses. So, it was a constant view. At the time, I would probably say it wasn't one of my all time favorites, but it was, one I always kind of, never hated when I watched it. And, really when I had, not seen it for a long time until I did it for my wonderful reviews of, and watching it again, I thought to myself, like, man, I was too young to fully appreciate how great this film actually is. And I think, I don't want to say it gets forgotten because it's not, it's a great film, but I think given what we get in a few films from now, it does tend to get forgotten a bit. Because some films we talk about are like considered like all time classics, and this one is kind of put in like that next tier below it. And it's just a really, really, really good film that doesn't get talked about enough, I don't think.
I would agree with that. I think it is. I'm with you. I would have only been 4 years old, so I didn't see it in the theater. I remember seeing it in theater later, so that must have been the 97, like when they brought it back out, because I do remember watching it and I remember being older and I was like in my brain somewhere along the way until my adulthood, I thought this movie came out later than it did. And I think that has something to do with seeing it in that 97 when they brought it back out kind of deal. I'm with you. Like a lot of us, we had these on VHS and it was an excellent movie. And I think you do have a certain group of people, not certain group as in like they're, but you have a cult that follows this movie and loves this movie. But overall, I think you hear about some that are coming up far more than you do this one most of the time.
I could see that. Agree? It's not. The thing is that it wasn't the event that some of the others were. You gotta understand, look, we don't like to talk about the stuff that we haven't gotten to yet, but we just break it down. It's like, look, Beauty and the Beast, first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture. So, Aladdin, Robin Williams with that phenomenal performance. Right. Lion King was like the highest grossing animated film of all time. Mm-hmm. So, that trio right there, that's your top of the list, your A. And yes, this is a little below. This is probably like huddled around with Pocahontas, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Hercules, Mulan. You know, like, but because you when you talk about Aladdin, Lion King, and Beauty and the Beast as a collective, they're just on another level. You know?
They are, for sure.
They are. They are, and that's no shade on any of these other films in this next grouping that we're getting into that aren't those films. But you know, those were. Those were just, you know, you get these once in a blue moon, but you got them in a row, you know, which never happens. And Little Mermaid has great performances, great voice cast, but it just, I don't know, it just doesn't have. And it's also, but the thing is too, that it's skewing to a female. When you know, Beauty and the Beast skews slightly female, but again, you got Aladdin, Lion King, those are right up the middle. So you've got a lot of boys that love those movies as well. That could also be why Little Mermaid probably is not as celebrated for some, because it is very skews, very, very girly.
No, of course, of course. I will say, in my opinion, I do think it paves the way for all of the ones coming up, though, making it, you know, the beginning of the Renaissance, of course, is because it kind of paves the way and changes, I don't know, maybe how we looked at things. In my opinion, this is our first princess that is far more expressive in her gesture, hand gestures, facial gestures, all of those things. And this is the first princess that we see that's really trying to, like, again, in my opinion, even though we talked about how much I've loved all of the ones that we've already discussed, like, this is the first one trying to, like, basically take her life in her own hands and make a decision for herself. Now, some people are going to come at me and be like, well, she's only, like, I think she's actually only, like, what, 14, technically? I get that. But 16. Isn't that the age? Yeah, she's somewhere in there. She's, like, 14, 16. It's to be debated depending on the actual Hans Christian Andersen story. But, like, isn't that when we all think that we're old enough to do that? Like, it's exactly what it is. It's kind of like a coming of age. Like, that's when we all think we're old enough to tell our parents to stuff it, right? I mean, which is essentially what's happening, except for she has a really funny sidekick and a very bossy sidekick.
Yeah, well, also, too, it's been 30 years since we've had a princess, really.
I mean,
you go back, I mean, all the way to Sleeping Beauty is probably the last true Disney princess that we had. You know, since then, it's been mostly... animals have been our main characters. This is the first time we've had a human or a human-esque character as our lead for quite some time.
Yeah, you're right, because Alice nor Alanwi are considered, either one of them are considered princesses in the lineup of what is claimed to be an actual Disney princess. Neither one of them are, although I argue very strongly that Alice should be, but that's another day.
Well, if you follow the Kingdom Hearts philosophy, she is a princess. That's for another day, like you said.
I think if you didn't hear that podcast, go back and listen to it. I think I actually maybe briefly like hint at my opinion on that there as well. But yeah. Oh, so overall, the story follows very loosely based on the Hans Christian Andersen story. We kind of begin in this open sea ship is coming to fog, lots of sailors having a good old time, and that's when we first meet our hero in Prince Eric. And this is, correct me guys, but doesn't everybody else just have like a basic name? They're just like, no, we have a Philip. Never mind. I was about to say, is this the first one that has an actual name? But no, we had Philip. So this is when we meet Eric and his dog and his advisor. And this is kind of where everything starts to play out most. And we see the really cool, we go under the sea, as Andy mentioned, and we get kind of those shots, kind of like the feature length of Naboo. We meet the sisters and all of that. So kind of in this opening, tell me your thoughts, Steve, on like how you thought when it opened. Like, did you think they did a really good job? Was it rushed? Talk about maybe even the cartooning on this, because it is starting to be a slightly different. I mean, we've seen it in a few of them, but we're every one of them, it develops a little bit more and a little bit more. So how do you feel about the opening and the cartooning that we have so far?
Well, I thought that the openings were fairly well done. I like the intro to Eric and his crew. I really like Max as a dog. I think he's kind of, you don't hear a lot about him as a great dog companion. And poor Grimsby having to be basically Eric's steward, and he's, you know, kind of dealing with having to deal with the seasickness and everything and, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. And then excuse me, I think I like the intro to like going under the sea. We see like Atlantica and we meet, you know, meet Triton, we meet Sebastian, like you said, all the his daughters, and you know, we got this big concert that they're doing that's supposed to be Ariel's debut, but she's nowhere to be found, much to everybody's chagrin. And we eventually see what she's doing, but yeah, I thought it was a, you know, good little opening to the film, kind of set the pace of what we're about to expect.
Andy, how do you feel about everything just kind of here at the beginning, cartooning, all that stuff?
Yeah, I love it. You know, Prince Eric, kind of a striking, handsome guy. In terms of the voice cast, I totally did not remember a lot outside of a couple of characters. And the Christopher Daniel Barnes voice is Prince Eric. Mm-hmm. For those of you who may not know that name, he was he was Greg Brady in the Brady Bunch movie. So I totally did not remember that he did that voice. And Grimsby was voiced by the same actor who did the voice of Roger. I'm sorry, Roger in 101 Dalmatians. Actually passed away right before this movie was out. And we also get, you know, once we go under the sea, it's great. Now, you know, you look up IMDb things, and okay. I went back and watched it, that you can actually see when King Triton comes in, you can see Mickey, Donald, Goofy, and they say Kermit, but I didn't see Kermit, but in the crowd of the
I tried really hard to look for Kermit as well, because everyone claims, but I'm with you. Mm-hmm. I did not see it.
Yeah, and I totally did not know that Kenneth Mars, the great character actor, did the voice of Triton. Then, you know, Kenneth Mars, who, you know, I think he was in, he was in the original Producers. He played the German guy. Mm-hmm. But if you saw him, you're like, oh, yeah, that's one of those, oh, yeah, that guy kind of people. So, but I love the animation, you know, the scary shark, you know, that chases them. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, sharks would probably be kept in place by the mer people. Obviously not. And then we get a great introduction to, you know, another character who I guess you'll speak on in a minute, mm-hmm. the overbearing sidekick.
Yes, that overbearing sidekick. I agree with you. You would think that sharks would be kept at bay, and I wonder if they just toe a fine line, and they kind of like stay right there on that edge just to see. So as you said, Steve, she's supposed to show up. She's not showing up. Ariel's nowhere to be found. She and her best friend Flounder the Fish, who by the way is one of my favorites. There are parts of this movie that he makes it. And then our other sidekick that we're going to get into, like, really takes it over the top, if that makes it, in a good way, in a good way. But her and her best friend, they're out kind of doing their thing, which is like scavenging, excavating, whatever you want to call it. And she finds a pipe and a fork, which is her dinglehopper. And like you said, she's unaware of that shark watching them. And he kind of busts in and gives chase, which is a fun little sequence, in my opinion. They kind of manage to get away from the shark, which is really funny. And this is when they meet their other friend, by the way, also funny, Scuttle. And she asks Scuttle to tell her what the items are that she's collecting. And this may be one of my favorite scenes in this whole movie, where he explains the dinglehopper. And it's used for humans to style hair. And I think this is one thing that, regardless of who you are watching this movie, you know, if someone else says a dinglehopper, what they are talking about. The snarfblatt, of course, is a pipe. And it's an object for making music. So how did you guys feel about Scuttle and his little introduction and his horrible ideas of what the human world really did with these objects? Andy, what do you think?
I adore Scuttle. He is voiced by the great Buddy Hackett, who is one of my favorite comedians growing up. My dad loved Buddy Hackett. So that voice always resonates with me. And him being so wrong and off base on his what he thinks human things are is hysterical, because it comes into play later. Mm-hmm. And we also didn't really talk about Horatio, Theolonius, Ignatius, Crustacean, Sebastian as well. Yes. I should have used that name. I should use that as a question in the trivia night. Maybe if we ever do that again and do Disney again, it will be. So if you're listening, write that down. But he is great. Samuel Wright does this incredible voice. And I also remember another reason that this movie resonates with me so much is because I saw this on Broadway as well. With we took Jessica. Jessica was like 3 or 4 years old at the time. And as if memory serves, Titus Burgess was Sebastian in the musical when we saw
it. Amazing.
Didn't know who he was. It doesn't know who he was at the time. But yeah, he was Sebastian in it. Didn't know then, but now. But yeah, and also Flounder is so childlike that, and such a good little friend. Yeah, he's great. And Max also, I didn't get to say anything. He's another Disney dog, I guess. That he does have his, make his presence felt a few times, especially towards the end of the movie. But yeah, this is just the supporting characters are really top notch in this film.
Oh, it's fantastic. I did not know that about Titus. I absolutely adore him. If you're unfamiliar with his work, he actually is very well known on Broadway. But most people will probably recognize him for being the Titus wonderful best friend to Kimmy. Titus Andromedon in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which he is excellent in as well. So that's another one to check out. Everyone that has played Sebastian at any point has usually done an impeccable job. Steve, how do you feel about kind of all this, our introduction to Scuttle and of course Titus, and then we're going to get into Ursula and all of that coming up. But like, how do you feel about these little side like poke fun characters?
I think they definitely make the movie. You know, Ariel's got to have her friends with her. You know, she's got, you know, Flounder, who always stays by her side, even though, you know, she gets them into like all sorts of, you know, dangerous adventures, and he's, you know, constantly scared, but he's always, you know, he's loyal to her. And then, like I said, you got Scuttle, who is, you know, tries to explain all this stuff the way he thinks of it is when it's completely, completely off base. And
like, so wrong.
Right. And honestly, I think Sebastian's one of the best characters that I think they've ever done, because he's got this, you know, he wants everything to be proper and right, and he's, you know, so loyal to Triton, and he, you know, wants to keep Ariel in line, and she just won't listen to him, and he gets so flustered, and it's just such a great he's like the complete opposite of Flounder, basically, and I think you definitely can relate to all these characters and their relationship to Ariel and how it helps her grow.
Yeah, I think he kind of reminds me of like the babysitter that your parents like trust and have all this confidence in, but what they don't know is when the door closes, how much of a butthead you are and how hard it is for them. I feel like that's what he is when it comes to taking care of her. You know, we've already seen in really two weird looking eels. Their names are actually Flotsam and Jetsam. They are spies for our sea witch and our main villain of the movie, Ursula. She uses Flotsam and Jetsam as her spies, and decides, you know, I want you to keep an eye on Ariel, because apparently she was a member of King Triton's court before being banished. Which there are some side stories that are more of, my brain has just, the word just went pew, like fanfic. There we go. There are some fanfic and theories that they actually had a relationship, and that's why she's bitter, and that's what I tell myself, so that's... that's what I go with. But she now hates Triton. So she obviously kind of wants to get at him. We have everything going on in the royal palace. Triton and Sebastian are scorning Ariel for missing a concert. Flounder, of course, is going to defend her. And in my opinion, I really feel Flounder acts very much like the little brother that just wants to follow you and be part of what you're doing and for you to accept him. So he comes to your aid, and like you said earlier, Steve, even though he's scared, he's following her. So that's what I've kind of like equated him to as well. Sebastian is the babysitter that's like, oh my God, would you just listen? You know, Flounder's just this poor little brother that just really wants to be part of everything that she does. This is when Triton, though, kind of forbids her from going to the surface, going, you know, up where they walk, where they run, because he's terrified of being caught by humans. And she believes, hey, humans aren't bad. And Triton asks Sebastian, he's too hard on Ariel, and Sebastian's like, definitely not. And suggests that maybe she needs constant supervision, which gives Triton the idea that Sebastian needs to keep an eye on her. So now this poor girl, by the way, is being followed around by eels and Sebastian. I mean, a little much. Sebastian's kind of thrown off. She's hurt, obviously. What girl of 14 to 16 would not be hurt? And this is when we get the wonderful song that I think most everyone knows, where she sings Part of Your World to the collection of her human objects. And you realize just how much she is infatuated with the human world in this moment. So with this being like one of the most well-known songs of the movie and kind of getting here, what did you think of like our snippet of introduction to Ursula, and how do you feel about this song? Steve, I'll go with you first this time.
So we've been on a, recent string of, some solid villains. We had the Horned King and Radigan and Sykes, but we step it up another level now here with Ursula, and it will continue on through these next couple of films. And, she thinks she's the queen bee, and, acts like she's the one, and she'll do anything she'll can to take power away from Triton. That's an interesting theory. I knew that I'd read about how they she was part of the kingdom at first and got banned or mm-hmm. got banished, and I mean that would kind of make sense that she was spurned by Triton, and that's why she harbored such a major grudge to him. So that definitely would make sense, and I think Flotsam and Jetsam are great sidekicks for her, like good henchmen for her to have. Part of Your World, I think, is definitely one of the trademark songs of this period. And we were talking about the voice act, the actors, and obviously we can't forget about obviously who voices Ariel, Jodie Benson, mm-hmm. and how she does a tremendous job singing the song. And I think one of the things I really enjoy about this period and what they do a really good job with is they treat these films like as if they could be translated to Broadway musicals. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is bringing in a gentleman, Howard Ashman, who would be a driving force of the music for the next couple of films. So I think he adds a lot of insight to it and really helps craft these films into proper musicals that we haven't really seen in any in our films to this point.
Okay. Andy, how do you feel about all of this that we have going on, our introduction to our villain, our wonderful song? Where are you at?
Teenagers, you give them an inch, they swim all over you. One of my favorite lines. But Ursula by the wonderful Pat Carroll, who just owns the screen when she's on there. I mean, I'm looking over. I have a collection of Disney snow globes, and I have the villains one. Mm-hmm. And she is on the bottom of the front, laying there, like kind of like Slave Girl Leia, a little bit of a pose. And she deserves to be as front and center as she is. I mean, she's flanked by Cruella and Jafar on one side and the Sleeping Beauty Maleficent and Captain Hook on the other side, and then inside the snow globe actually is the Wicked Queen from Snow White. So she is prominent, as she should be, one of the greatest villains ever in the history of any of Disney animation. She tells her story so wonderful. Flotsam and Jetsam are your atypical pair of henchmen, as we've talked about, but they have more personality than we've seen in a while in terms of the henchmen. Those freaky yellow eyes are very, very scary. And Steve had a lot of great points about the music. Wonderful Jodie Benson, who just her voice is just so tremendous and perfect for Ariel, mm-hmm. singing and talking. And Part of Your World is all timer in terms of, with so many iconic images also from that scene, as if you see like on Disney compilations and of part of like all kinds of, great in terms of anytime they use any clips from this movie. Yeah. And it's just, I just adore it. And Howard, Howard Ashman, and also Alan Menken does the score on this film. And I'm sure if our good friend Glenn Butler was here, he would be going on because he's a big scores guy. And just the feeling that you get, you know, it's like one of those movies where like just your emotions are go up and down based on the score a lot. And it's so great. It's so wonderful.
It is fantastic. And it really kind of leads us into where everything is going, her obsession with the human world. And Jodie Benson, for those that you don't know, look up her other works that she's done. She's a fantastic voice actress. And in my opinion, I love the fact that Ariel is both sung and voiced by the same person, because a lot of times you'll look back and you'll realize that the person doing the singing was not the voice of the character. So the fact that she does both of those is phenomenal. Down while she's doing all of this, she's distracted, and that leads her to kind of pop up and see what's going on. And that's when she finds the ship shooting fireworks into the night sky. We get another glimpse at Eric, and she's kind of enamored, especially with Eric there. Which there's some really funny back and forth at this point when she's talking about Eric, and Scuttle thinks she's talking about the dog. She's talking about Max, about how pretty Max is.
He's kind of hairy, if you ask me.
Kind of hairy, just a little bit. I love that Andy can do these voices because I want to and I can't. and in this interaction that we get with Eric, he's talking to Grimsby again. It's apparently Eric's birthday. He protests he's not found the right girl and says he'll know when he's found her. There's this kind of horrendous statue that's presented to him. And I was kind of like, why would they present him with a statue on board the ship? Wouldn't they wait until they're back at the castle for this nonsense? But okay. And without warning, a hurricane blows in. And I don't know if you've ever lived anywhere where a hurricane was, but there is warning. So there's just that. But anyway, without warning, hurricane blows in, sweeps the ship and the crew violently, and they go back and forth. Ariel is even thrown off, but manages to catch sight of the ship being struck by lightning. And she sets the ship on fire. That is a lot there, boys and girls. Basically, the whole crew overboard, like, oh my God. I mean, it is a hurricane and there's lightning. What did you expect? Eric manages to get Max to safety, but he can't save himself. Of course, we all saw this coming. And Ariel rescues Eric and takes him back to shore. Of course, once at shore, Ariel sings to him of her desire to join Eric's world before fleeting away because Grimsby and Max are approaching. Eric manages to catch a glimpse of this, though, before she leaves. And he's like, remembers this girl who saved him. And he is very determined to find her, much like a prior prince who was very determined to find out who wore the glass slipper. So I'm seeing a theme here. No one else has figured it out by now. She watches from a nearby rock, which is one of the scenes that everybody thinks the most. If you see most Little Mermaid stuff, when you see it, you see her splashed up on the rock with her hair everywhere. I like the version, though, if you guys have ever seen it, where it's like the picture of her splashed up on the rock with her hair flying back, and it's like Disney, and then it's like reality, and her hair is like all hanging in her face, and like it didn't go well. You guys should look it up. It's really funny. So this is our moment when we have our neat, cute, if you will. If you are a romance fan or a romantic comedy fan, you will know what I'm talking about. So basically, I guess this is our meet cute. So it's cute that he almost died in a hurricane and she saved him, I guess. So guys, what do you think about this reintroduction of Eric and her such having such a desire of the human world that this all plays out? Did you feel like it went too fast? Like it went really well?
All right. Yeah, I agree with you. Lugging that big ass statue on the boat should have been, they should have just left it. Yeah. You know, they should have just left it on shore. I mean, no, that doesn't seem very practical. You know, the hurricane.
Like you're asking to sink. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is too. It's just causing trouble, man. You know, and you know what? You can only have so much weight on a boat. I did write in, you know, it's fireworks at sea, like a Disney cruise.
Maybe that that's where they got the idea. That is, yeah, probably. I didn't think about that.
You know, and of course, yeah, she saves him, and she sings as he's like on shore, and you have that iconic shot. I actually have that ornament. The keepsake ornament of her on the rocks, which goes up every year. And it, I mean, I enjoy the meet cute. I think it's fine. You know, what comes next with her expressions, you know, it's some interesting storytelling, that they implore and how, it's a fairy tale, so you gotta really tell yourself that as much as you, right. You know, that part of your brain you need to shut off your lack of suspension of disbelief. I think it's cute though. I think it's one of the Eric is one of the more fleshed out princes, you know, that we've seen at this up to this point. So he definitely has his own personality, he's his own character. He's not just there for like set design, set dressing. So I enjoy their meet cute.
Okay. And Steve, how do you feel about all this?
I think the one thing we're kind of over glossing here is that does Grimsby think that Eric's that conceited that he'll accept a statue of himself as a birthday gift? I mean, seriously.
That's another valid point.
Grimsby needs to read the room a little better.
Yeah, no kidding.
I think it's just maybe expected, like he's a prince, and it's expected of him to want to have a statue of himself. Like it's supposed to be an honor. So like maybe that also leads to like the kind of character that this prince is for once. Like he's not the conceited, like I just want to marry, I just want a statue kind of guy. That is a valid point that I didn't think of. Like there are a lot of things going on here. Did he want the statue, and why the hell is it on the ship? Like I'm just saying.
Yeah, because you can see him like visually, you can see him cringe when he sees it. And even Max hates it because he growls at it. So, yeah, that was an interesting thought. Also, Max quickly sniffs out Ariel and quickly falls in love with her. So that's a key point there. Yeah, talk about a hurricane coming out of nowhere. Just, you know, because it's like all calm seas and all of a sudden, like, boom, here comes the storm. You talk about, you know, why is the statue on the ship? Well, that's the impetus for Ariel to have it in her room, I guess. So they got to get it out there somehow. But, yeah, that was definitely, fun, you know, kind of cool little scene there. And like you said, you know, she saves him and brings him on the beach and, you know, he does get a quick visual of her, but he only remembers her from when she sings. So I thought that was a nice little touch there. And then, yeah, like you said, that like iconic shot of her on the rock as the water splashes behind her was like all over the TV spots when it was, you know, being advertised. So definitely some iconic imagery there.
Yeah, for sure. I don't. Here's another thing about that damn statue. Okay, how did Flounder get that into her grotto? Because that shit is heavy, and Flounder's a little fishy. So I don't know how he did it. I don't know. Sorry, guys, I'm questioning that.
No, guys, as you can tell, we have a lot of issues with this horrid statue. Note to everyone out there: don't make your loved one a statue of themselves unless they are that vain. And if you're going to, don't present it to them on a boat. Okay.
Exactly. I can't wait to see the write up for the description of this episode. The three of them talk about their hatred of the statue.
Miranda that said don't take it on a boat. Not that any of us even have a boat, but there's that.
Has a statue been as hated on a pod ever? I don't know.
I don't know. Probably just have to
listen to find out.
So in all of this, Ariel makes a very bold proclamation that she will be part of Eric's world. And what she doesn't realize that has been happening this whole time that we mentioned earlier is she's being followed around by those scuzzy eels, Flotsam and Jetsam, right? And Ursula is very gleeful to hear that she has stumbled across this little vision Ariel has made for herself. And that's when we see, it's actually kind of creepy, this eerie looking gaggle of, they're calling them polyps. When you look on the Disney Wiki, they're referred to as polyps in her lair. And these are all the former dreamers who have come to power. And then she's like, this will be a charming addition to my group. Because again, she just wants to upset Triton. It's all she wants to do. So a few days time goes by, Ariel is daydreaming of Eric, and this piques the curiosity of her father. What father would not be intrigued with his daughter suddenly like humming and doodying around the way she's doing? And he thinks, naive as he is, because let's all face it, Triton is a little on the naive side. He's a little on the doesn't get it side. And he thinks she is in love with another merman. And of course, Sebastian is a nervous wreck trying to keep the secret because Sebastian has also been watching her. And she decides, I'm going to visit Eric. But Sebastian is having none of that. None of that. And this is where he attempts to bring her back down to, which I found this funny, this quote funny. It says he attempts to bring her back down to earth with a musical number about how the sea is better than the land. But no, he would not be trying to bring her back down to earth. He's trying to bring her back down to the ocean and get her off the land. So this is when we get, I think, the most iconic song from this whole movie, Under the Sea, which I absolutely love. So he's bringing all these fish together for a sing-along party, and Flounder shows up, and it's an amazing little scene. So I need both of you to tell me how amazing this song is, because we all agreed it is, I'm pretty sure, right? I mean, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think Little Mermaid songs, that's the first one you think of. And it really kind of would be the template for the future films and like the big musical numbers that we would see like that. And you're just seeing like all that, you know, that energy and, you know, the mute, you know, just everyone, you know, dancing and singing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, for, you know, all that effort Sebastian put in and sadly was all for naught because she just left anyway. So, but
pretty much.
Yeah. But yeah, well, you definitely think when you think trademark songs of this era, this is definitely one that's high up on the list.
Oh, without question. Andy, where are you with this song?
Oh, I love it. Just hearing the first like few notes of it. It does. It gets you in a good mood. It's a big musical production, and how cleverly worded it is about getting all the species of fish in there. Poop plays the hop and the do fluke is a duke of so yeah. Like it's so great how it incorporates the whole environment and tells the story, and Sebastian is letting out is finally getting a lot of personality out of Sebastian, and he's having a grand old time. And as Steve said, yeah, it's all for naught because Ariel just leaves and goes away because, you know, she's not listening. She's a hard-headed teenager. Very hard.
100%. 100%. She's definitely not here for any of that. She does slip away. And then that's when the song ends, she's gone, and the Royal Herald calls for Sebastian to report to the king about Ariel, actually. And Sebastian, afraid that Triton figured out what happened, accidentally slips the truth during the meeting and is forced to tell the king everything. I mean, this little guy just can't keep a secret. So at the grotto, Flounder reveals that he has saved the statue of Eric from the wreck. Here's the freaking statue again. Again, I don't understand how this happened. Maybe he had some other fish friends. I don't know. But I know most things sink to the floor. So there's that. Anyway, less about the statue. Sorry, guys. This is all interrupted, though, by Triton. And there's a heated argument, which, hello, didn't we see that coming? And she confronts her dad and tells him, you know, I rescued him and I love him. Don't get me started on that either. And she breaks down sobbing. He actually blasts all the secret charges in her grotto and reduces them to just junk, which broke my heart for her, honestly, because he truly doesn't get it. He's a hothead, right? Flotsam and Jetsam, though, still hanging out. Still hanging out. And this time they want to be her friend and convince her that Ursula will be her friend to achieve her dreams, which leads us to the next most amazing song in Disney history, one of the, with the amazing Poor Unfortunate Souls in Pain, in Need. I think we're going to talk more about music, obviously, and the stupid statue than anything in this movie. So I need both of you to, like, let's tell me how amazing this song is. Because in my opinion, and I think we talked about this before, we were kind of sort of like joking around about ranking villains. Ursula's up there pretty high for me. She even kind of tells on herself in this song and pretends to be her friend, but says, you know, I admit in the past I've been nasty. They weren't really kidding when they called me a witch. But she tries to act like she's repented and she's here to help her. This song is so catchy and so fun. Maybe not as like fun as the one we had right before this, but still a lot of fun. Andy, I think I started with you. Mm-hmm. You went last time. Okay, so Andy, talk to me about Poor Unfortunate Souls. Where does it rank in the song of villains? And where does she kind of rank in your villains? I know we've, like I said, we briefly talked about it, but now we're hitting where they're all coming up. So where does she fall and where does the song fall?
Up to this point, she's actually the top villain, I think. Okay. Her position may change in a few films, but she's definitely, you know, all-time top five, top ten probably.
For sure.
You know, the way she tells her story and through the, you know, how conniving she is, how much she emotes. I mean, she's just kind of, you know, you look at the mer people and they're like, you know, sleek and they're half fish. And then you got her, it was black, huge, half octopus kind of thing with the bottom half. Mm-hmm. So she's definitely different and ostracized, very convincing, has that deep voice of hers and just conveys so much through the song. I mean, again, we go back to the casting, we go back to Alan Menken and Howard Sherman here with their score and their music and everything. And it's just an incredible combination. It's a villain song that I can listen to over and over and over. I think Under the Sea is more popular, but this actually may be a better song in terms of just what it does and how it moves the story forward and what it does for the character who sings it. It's Under the Sea is a great musical number, but this has such weight to it. Oh my God. Because it tells you everything you need to know about Ursula and what kind of magic Ariel is getting herself involved in, which is not all the wisest, but she still goes ahead with it.
Yeah, I mean, because she is. She's kind of telling on herself. She's telling you exactly who she is, and I think that has a lot to do with the reason why she is not as fun and quote unquote as beautiful as the rest of the creatures under the sea, because she's this dark hearted, horrible witch. Like, I almost feel like she has turned herself into the way she looks. Steve, where are you with her on the ranking of, I guess we'll keep it at to this point, because we do like to, I like how Andy did that. We do like to try to not go ahead and bring in what's coming, but to this point, where does she fall for you? And how does this song, which, in my opinion, one thing that the songs do that I haven't mentioned before now is they actually tell the story itself. Like, you could listen to just the soundtrack of this and it tells the, lays out what's going on. And I think that's what's fantastic. But where do you lay all of this out?
Well, first, before then, Gimmitz, just to quickly backtrack about, Sebastian, you know, can't keep the secret. And, you know, Triton just went full, like, beast mode on Ariel's treasures there, and you know you can't really blame Ariel for, you know, following, you know, Flotsam and Jetsam to Ursula, because you know she's kind of, as we've been seeing, kind of like the rebellious teenager, and you know, she's, if she, you know, she wants, you know, to be with the man that she's fallen in love with, so you know she's gonna take this avenue. Ursula is in my top three villains. She is definitely one of the most iconic and memorable. And the song, Poor Unfortunate Souls, is definitely one of the better songs performed by a villain. It's in my top 50. And yeah, it's just like you said, you know, Ursula is not, you know, unlike these other villains that, you know, kind of hide, you know, kind of put on this facade that they're doing something what they think is good and they're hiding this nefarious plot. You know, Ursula's up front about it. She's like, yeah, I can give you, I'll give you what you want, but it's, you know, going to come at a cost. You know, you got to either, you know, you got to get him to fall in love with you in 3 days or you basically become my property. So,
right. You know, there's a hefty price to this. She does not. That's what I respect about her, not to interrupt you, but that's what I respect about her as a villain is she lays out exactly what she is. She has a contract and all and says, sign this. This is what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, like you said, Ariel, you know, she hesitates for a second, but the temptation is just too strong, and she ends up, you know, signing the contract, and she gets to be, you know, she gets to be a human, but at the cost of, you know, losing her voice. So the one thing that Eric remembered about her, she now has lost. So
exactly,
you know, she's gonna have to find another way to get him to remember her.
Do you think, since we are talking about, like, she's giving away the one thing that he remembers her by, do you think in that moment she's just so desperate because she would be, like, a teenager who, like, maybe just had her room taken off her door and her cell phone taken away and her car keys, like, by him destroying her grotto to equate it to, like, a modern-day teenager, which wouldn't be the same for us because we didn't have, like, cell phones and stuff. But, like, let's equate it to, like, a modern-day teenager. And you took away her cell phone, you took away her car keys, you took away, like, her freedoms of all kind, and then she's just so angry, she actually gives away the one thing that connects her to this person that she loves so dearly. Do you think it's an irrational teenager decision at that moment? What do you guys think? Like, it's totally irrational, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
That's kind of how I feel. I feel a lot of this, even though it's a mermaid tale, and it's Disney, and there's so much made up. There's actually a lot that can equate to real life. If you, like I said, you, the grotto is like her things as a teenager that she thinks are hers and shouldn't be taken. And, you know, most teenagers, guys and girls, not all of them, but a lot go through this, but I love them phase, you know. And so it's kind of really funny. So as you said, she gives up the one thing that Eric knows her for. And she's got to get that true love's kiss, which going forward, looking back and going forward all the way even to the show Once Upon a Time, true love's kiss from here to eternity in the terms of Disney means something big. And she has to get that true love's kiss before sunset on the third day. Or she belongs to Ursula, period. And she's explained that to her. She even signed a contract. So she'll give her legs for now so she can go be like the normal humans because that's what keeps her from being a human. She has her voice trapped in a necklace and Ursula's not going to wear it. She's transformed into a human. Sebastian and Flounder escape Flotsam and Jefferson's grass and take her to the surface where she groups up with Scuttle on a beach near Eric's castle. Sebastian kind of threatens to go back and tell King Triton about the deal Ariel made, but Ariel manages to convince him, somehow with no voice, to, you know, help them. And Scuttle then tells Ariel about how to blend in with humans, and the first step is to dress like them. And Scuttle takes a portion of the sail for Ariel to wear, which I think is fantastic. I used to do this as a kid, too. I used to tie a blanket around me and pretend I was Ariel in the sail. And this is when Prince Eric actually arrives, and he doesn't know that she's the girl that saved his life, but he's willing to bring her to the castle to be taken care of because clearly, I mean, she's wobbling around on these legs like a foal. I mean, honestly, she's only had them as long as a baby foal has, and she can't speak. So he's clearly thinking that she has had some sort of shipwreck as well, and that he needs to take care of her. This leads up to another thing that I find most hysterical is a little scene with Sebastian where Ariel's inside. She's taking a bath and Sebastian is sent through a very unfortunate series of events to the castle kitchen. And that's where Sebastian encounters a seafood obsessed chef who attempts to cook him and we get a wonderful song that I've always had a very hard time pronouncing. I won't even lie. We know Miranda mispronounces things all the time. It's been 5 years of her podcasting. If you don't know that, you're new here. Hi. So I'll stop kind of here at this, and we'll kind of I'll let both of you kind of talk about her now having legs, and this wonderful song and this conflict that goes on in the kitchen that is absolutely phenomenal, in my opinion. It's so funny, and you've got the quintessential chef with his little mustache. So this is when everything is kind of warming up. Where do you think about this whole little sequence, her on the beach, going into the castle, and of course this fantastic song? Steve, I'll let you go first this time.
Yeah, so her discovering her legs for the first time is definitely an interesting scene there, because she's like trying to learn to walk, and these, you know, and Flounder scuttle and Sebastian trying to help her. And interesting note, as I mentioned, Max recognizes her when he sees her.
Yeah, I'm sure her smell would be the same, right?
Yeah, but like we said, without her voice, Eric doesn't know her from the next girl. So, so she's got to find a way to get him to fall in love with her. And that poor Sebastian happened to fall into that kitchen where Chef Louis is cooking, and that song, Les Poissons, I think is how you pronounce it. He's just like so into his work, but then this like he goes on this like wild goose chase against Sebastian and just gets the crap beat out of him. Yeah, but he takes the licking, but he keeps trying to get him, and he gets unfortunately gets scolded by the one maid there at the end there, because she doesn't know what's going on, and Sebastian somehow ends up on Grimsby's plate, and Ariel's able to get him to come to hers before Grimsby eats him. So just a fun sequence of scenes there to kind of where you see Ariel kind of finally having to adjust to being a human, and Sebastian experiencing the horrors of humanity that he's always been afraid of.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the horror story for him. Like, he probably in his dreams have been like, "Oh God, no, can't go to the shore." Andy, how do you feel about all of this here going on?
Les poissons. How I love les poissons. I have to chop and they serve little fish. I love this song. This is, we said this is the best one. This is probably one of the most fun songs we have in any Disney movie. Rene Auberjonois, who does the voice of Louis in this one scene, we only see Louis briefly later on. It steals the show for me right this far. One of my friends loves this song, and he would always kind of hum it along out of nowhere. It is got to be like a horror story for Sebastian, because, it's just... he talks about the whole cooking process, basically. And at first I chop off their heads and I pull out their bones. And Sebastian is horrified the entire time. It is so, so good. John Stamos does butcher this later on when they do that Disney Little Mermaid live on ABC. That was, he's a huge Disney fan. God bless him. Bless his heart, so to speak. But bless he does not his, do.
That's the kind of not, bless his heart he gets.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, he doesn't do the song justice. Just to backtrack slightly, though, got this pretty mute girl that looks like she survived, and she does emote a lot with her facial expressions. Mm-hmm. So, you see how Eric takes pity on her or just shows some kindness and brings her in, and now we get all of her miseducation of Scuttle comes into play with the dingle hopper and the whatever she calls the star flax, or how she takes the pipe, and Grimsby kind of does not have the best dinner here. He gets a pipe soot on him, and his crab is missing. So Grimsby's not having a great time, and then he suggests that they go on a nice walk. And this is really fun how she's getting acclimated to being on land. Very, very fun scene.
Absolutely. What I really kind of like about this is, it again shows to the, I think, character of Prince Eric and how they actually built him well, if that makes sense. again, kind of going back to, like, he was disgusted by the statue. He clearly is not as vain as what most princes are supposed to be. And then her just finding, he finds a random girl and says, no, I have to help her. And what's really funny is they kind of bat a few eyelashes at the fact that she's treating things wrong, but then they just kind of think amnesia. Like, you know, they just kind of, they all kind of look at each other like, well, we did find her on the shore. Like, And I love that no one is considering that she's a mermaid. No one.
No, I don't think, because I've never seen one. Hey, here's the thing, Miranda, as a woman, you're probably going to talk about. So she just gets legs, right? And she's just learning how to walk. The girl's already in heels in the next scene. Come on.
I am. All right, I'll go. You asked for this. I will be 37 in a month and a half. I did pageants for a brief period of time. Yes, I won a few. So clearly, at one point in my life, I somehow knew how to walk in heels. But I faked it really well. I would like to know how, after less than 24 hours of having legs, long legs, by the way, by the look of them, she can delicately walk in these pieces of torture device. Because it's unrealistic. That's like the most unrealistic part of this movie, besides that stupid statue.
Can you guys tell I've been podcasting Miranda a long time? I really know how to wind her up.
Just a little bit. I mean, seriously, tell me a good story. I know there's some absurdity, but this is the most absurd thing you could have given me. Like, you want me to believe that she can fall in love in 3 days? Fine. My Hallmark Love and Heart, which is caused by Disney, says, yeah, they can fall in love in 3 days and get married. Fantastic. But walking on high heels after less than 24 hours of having legs, absurd. Not possible. Unrealistic.
Okay. Now I'm just visioning everybody. You know, those that have been waiting for us to get to this point and talk about this film, and they finally listened to, like, these people have a really must have some serious issues with statues and high heels. Like, what am I listening to? Like, what are we doing? Is, to quote Tim Capel.
Yeah, no, Tim will be like, oh, there's Miranda. Tim will know. The funniest part about this is we are not a podcast where we, like, visually see each other when we're doing this. And I can imagine, if anyone follows her name on TikTok or Instagram, her name is Elise, and she explains things. She's kind of gone viral when she explains things with her hands. Just to let you know how Miranda explains things, that's how I was just sitting at my table here and going over high heels. But I will move past that, if only for a moment. And this is when Triton has learned of the horrible situation, and he's sending all kinds of search parties, as any good father should, which he needs to take a minute, inner reflect, and realize that this is his fault. But that's not either here nor there. Am I calling him a bad parent? Maybe only slightly. But, you know, okay. So, they can't find her anywhere. The next morning, they begin their tour of the kingdom. Of course, before this, I should reiterate or go back to, we've already talked about, she has to get that true love's kiss, right? So Sebastian actually discusses a plan, which, it's kind of funny that a switch has flipped, and I think it's more out of preservation for himself and Ariel, because he doesn't want to see her hurt, and he doesn't want to see her get turned over to Ursula. He has developed a plan to get Eric to kiss Ariel. And Ariel's not listening. She's being too enamored with the human world and its splendors. And she falls asleep. And he's like, she is completely hopeless, which is one of my favorite lines he gives. Because most teenage girls are completely hopeless. And he drifts off to sleep, of course, too. I'm thinking he's enjoying his time in this castle, minus the kitchen, just a tad bit. They begin their tour of the kingdom, starting with a nearby town. And she's, of course, enamored with every single thing she sees. Puppets, horses, dancing. Because she's never seen any of this. And I'm assuming Eric is still thinking, oh, she has amnesia. This is all cool to her. Woohoo! But then that's when we get, and I've said this like three times, everybody's like, oh, Miranda, come on, decide which song is your favorite. I can't and I will not. Thank you. We get the most amazing song, though, called Kiss the Girl, This is Sebastian's plan. There you see her sitting across the way. Everyone knows this. I won't sing it. If you want to hear me sing, go listen to the wonderfully written Christmas play that we did, but I will not be trying that this evening. What I love about this is through this whole song, like we have the whole Sebastian's over there. There you see her. And Eric's like, did you hear something? And of course, you know, Ariel's like, oh, this is my moment. And he's like, yes, you want her. And my favorite part is the sha-la-la-la-la-la, oh my. Yeah, that does it for me. That hits something in my, right? Keep that sad, ain't it a shame? Yeah. So this is when Eric is still talking to her, though, because, like, he thinks he hears this. And it almost makes me wonder if it's kind of like that thing in Toy Story where we don't hear the toys doing their thing. If, like, all of these creatures doing their thing, to Eric, it's just, like, crickets and splashing water. That's just my theory. So this song is fantastic. And it ranks pretty high up there on my list of Disney songs. We have some that are going to come higher later. You can guess at them if you would like. But where do you guys both rank this song in the whole ranking of your Disney songs? And I guess I'll keep it with to this point. Andy, where are you at? I know you love this song as well. I think we can love every song in this movie, but, you know, there's that.
Yeah, it's high up. It's upper middle, I would think. It's really fantastic use of you know, storytelling here.
Absolutely.
You know, the different subtleties with the different animals singing going along. It's almost like a cappella, so to speak, because you can kind of like that's how they're going for the vibe there. Mm-hmm. And I like when he's trying to guess her names and he's Mildred and all these other like names, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he's finally like, it's Ariel. Her name is Ariel. Ariel. And she's like, yeah. Very, with her very expressive, beautiful eyes. It is a wonderful song, wonderful thing. And you really think it's going to happen there. But
you do.
Flotsam and Jetsam kind of mess things up here with the they're about to kiss and the boat capsizes. And then Ursula is just I think Ursula's had enough. And she's like, you want something done? You got to do it yourself. I think that's what we got coming.
Pretty much. I also really like the visuals while this whole song is going on. So, Steve, where is Kiss the Girl on your ranking list? And how do you feel about this whole scene here? And Flotsam and Jetsam, by the way, are assholes. I'll just go ahead and put that out there.
Yeah. I had this pretty high on my rankings. You can obviously go to placebnature.com and, you know, if you just go in the search bar and type Disney songs, you'll have the list there. It's definitely a really, you know, beautiful song, and, you know, Sebastian's doing his damnedest to make sure that they, you know, they kiss and that she, you know, gets, you know, she can stay human. And unfortunately, I get, you know, I know Scuttle's trying to help, but he's not doing jack with his singing, unfortunately. you know, way off key and everything. Just leave it to the professional, Scuttle. And yeah, like I said, Flotsam and Jetsam, you know, ruin it at the last minute. And Ursula's kind of realizing, you know, oh crap, she's getting too close for comfort. So like Andy said, yeah, if you want to do the job right, do it yourself, as we're about to see.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Which is really funny because we knew, I mean, realistically, we all knew that it wasn't going to happen that easy. There was just no way that we were getting it that easy, even though we all wanted to. This kind of frustrates Ariel's progress. That, you know, obviously you guys alluded to, Ursula is very frustrated. Sorry, I left her name out. Frustrated with progress. And she's going to take matters into her own tentacles. And she transforms herself into this beautiful young maiden named Vanessa. And that's when she comes along and actually hypnotizes Eric with her voice. Because, again, remember, that's what he remembers from being saved, is this beautiful voice. And she has a way to use it as like a tranquilizer, like a come hither too, as well. And he announces his true feelings to not Ariel that he was going to do, but he announces that he's going to marry Vanessa. And they're going to get married by sunset, which, okay, I'll go on another small tangent. I know you're a prince, but are you meaning to tell me that that poor sod in the kitchen has to prepare a whole wedding meal and a cake before sunset on the same day? As an adult, there are some logistics to all this that really make my head and my ADHD just go, what the? Anyway. So this actually breaks Ariel's heart as the wedding ship is departing away there from port. Again, why on a ship? But okay. Ariel and her friends are left kind of, you know, there behind while Vanessa plays her role as this love-struck woman. She's clinging to Eric's side, so she's raising no suspicion. But Ariel witnesses the ship sailing off, and she really began weeping over this loss. Little does anyone know, though, Scuttle happens to kind of fly over the wedding ship when he hears Ariel's voice, because he would know his friend's voice. And it's coming from the bride's dressing room, and he spies. And once Vanessa takes a look at the dressing room mirror, Ursula's reflection is shown, not Vanessa's, obviously. And that's when Scuttle flies away and tells Ariel about everything. And the group then forms a new plan. And Ariel and Flender go after the wedding ship on a barrel because she's got human legs. It ain't like she can speed out there real quick with the mermaid. Whatever, yeah. Mermaid, that's a thing now, guys. Her mermaid. and they go tell King Triton what's happening, too. So Scuttle can kind of stall the wedding. He gathers all the lagoon and sea creatures. There's bluebirds and flamingos and pelicans and just, it's unreal. And he has them all kind of like converge on the wedding ship as it's underway to kind of like make it stop. And there's little warning for Vanessa when the attack begins, which is kind of cool that we could throw Ursula off her game because she seems to have been able to see everything up to this point, right? And she's very flustered and disoriented and sidelined from really being able to do anything, especially thanks to the help of Max, who I knew would come into play at some point. So I'll stop right here before we kind of get any further, because now we're really kind of getting to the meat, I guess you would say, of the situation. So, Andy, how did you feel when we see the villain actually come in and do what we knew she was going to do? I mean, at some point, like, I'll be honest, I was still a little bit like, oh, how dare she? Like, she told us she was going to do this, but she did it sooner than she agreed to. So she's kind of breaking the contract. So where are you at with all of this going on? How do you feel kind of like on both sides? And I don't know. Give me your opinions here.
Yeah, well, Eric's just a fool for love. But
apparently.
You can't play it. I mean, Ursula is a do-it-yourself. She's a modern squid woman, you know? She doesn't need no man or henchman to do this for her. You know, she does play a little, you know, dirty pool here, so to speak, where she, you know, makes herself into this beautiful woman and uses the voice that Eric knew and to hypnotize him. And yeah, I understand the plight of the staff here of having to get all this prepared and done, especially this tiered wedding cake. I mean, come on.
Right.
But you got to hand it to, you know, Scuttle, you know, rallies the troops. You know, this is where they kind of like come together and they all do their play. Like, you know, Sebastian heads off to talk to the king. Flounder brings Ariel to the boat since she needs the help. And Max, man, Max is the unheralded hero here because he ain't going to fool Max. So he's the one that sniffs out, you know, that something right here. Yeah, it's building to a fun, exciting climax of the movie. So I'm excited.
For sure. Steve, where are you at with the sequencing leading up to everything and kind of where we're at this moment?
Well, like we mentioned, you know, Ursula, you know, you only saw her plan go up in smoke. So it's like, you know, she's got to do it herself. So, you know, she turns into this beautiful woman and then uses Ariel's voice to lure Eric to her and hypnotize him. And, You don't think about, you never thought about the logistics of having to get all that together in such a short time, but you know, that's just Disney logic for you, I guess. Scuttle inadvertently, you know, doing something right for a change. You know, he just happens to see Ursula look at herself in the reflection, and she's, you know, he realizes who it really is. So, you know, they managed to, you know, get them, you know, get it back to Ariel. And I tell you, considering Flounder's the only one pulling that barrel with Ariel, riding on it, they make good time catching up to that ship because they brilliant, you know, far in the distance. Like you said, you know, Max, you know, he knows right off the bat, and you know, Ursula, you know, giving them that little kick in the face, you know, cause it's like, you know, you're gonna get yours for that one, and. obviously, you know, we talk about, you know, certain things, and I don't know if you guys remember the whole, the rumors going about that, that the priest, resigning over the wedding, had what looked like, some thought he was maybe a little bit too excited, presiding over this wedding. I remember there was all that, you know, the controversy surrounding that, and then, like you said, the, you know, the sea creatures all kind of convene on this thing led by Scuttle, and they break things up, and then, like you said, Max gets his at the end when he gives Ursula, you know, a bite on her backside, and that, you know, causes the seashell to break, and Ariel gets her voice back. So, you know, kind of you think everything's gonna be all right, but you know, just a little bit too late there.
Mm-hmm. What I love is watching all those animals that he had kind of convene together on the ship, like attack her. And then as he's attacking her, like he actually, like you said, Max is really kind of the unsung hero here because he's growling at her. He knows that something is not right. I am a proponent of animals know. Like, animals know when somebody is a shithead, basically. Like, they know. So I kind of love that he gets in a part of this. Because as you said before, Steve, I think it may have been you, talking about how, you know, he kind of really has fallen in love with Ariel. And he really cares for Ariel, Max does. So he snaps the necklace off, reveals it to Vanessa, shatters across the deck. And Eric finds Ariel and admits that she's the one who saved him. But Vanessa warns Eric to leave Ariel alone before realizing that her voice was now Ursula's. Like, if she tries to speak and she's back to boo, you know. But before Ariel and Eric can kiss, the sun starts to set and Ariel turns back into a mermaid. And Ursula transforms into her ginormous, ugly self, her true form, taking Ariel back under the sea. But it's not long before Ursula thinks of the next thing to do, and she runs into Triton and Sebastian, and major conflict really occurs here. Triton confronts Ursula and demands her to release Ariel, but that's not going to happen. And Ursula counters by insisting that Ariel is now her slave, like she broke the contract. Triton hears Ariel apologizing to him, and he attempts to destroy the contract. But it's binding. Like, I don't know whose lawyer, like, what kind of lawyer Ursula has under the sea there, what kind of magical entity lawyer, but it's binding. It's not how this works. It is magically enhanced by being legal. So Triton saves Ariel and signs the contract and becomes a polyp in her place. And I love that they refer to them as a polyp because I don't know that that's what I would call these little things. I don't know. But this is when Eric takes a rowboat from the wedding ship leading to Ariel's location. And Ursula claims Triton's crown and trident and becomes queen of the sea. And of course, this would anger anyone. So Ariel is to the point of attacking her. Ursula attempts to use the trident for sabotage. But Eric goes underwater and hits Ursula with a harpoon, which, okay. Ariel then reminds Eric to look out while Ursula commands Flotsam and Jetsam to drown him. And he swims to shore, but it's pulled by Flotsam and Jetsam again, while Flounder and Sebastian witness the whole commotion. They, to save Eric, come to his aid and attack the two eels. So there is a lot going on in this sequence right here. And I like wrote in my notes, why is she so big? I didn't remember that part. Like, I know she's magical here, but like, So she has enough voodoo, that's what I'm going with, that she can make this contract legally binding. And then she can also, like, make herself bigger than before. Like, I don't know about that. So there's a lot of chaos going on. What do we think about, because, again, like, this is all happening kind of fast, really. What do you guys think about all this? Steve, you go first, because I don't remember who I let go first last time. Steve, you go first and kind of tell me how you're feeling about this whole section of the movie here.
Well, like I said, you know, Ariel gets her voice back, but it's, you know, too little too late, because the sun sets as she goes back to being a mermaid.
Right.
So, you know, Ursula is going to get what she wants, and, you know, Triton shows up to help, and, you know, Ursula's whole end game was to get power, and she knew that she could use Ariel as collateral, in essence, and, you know, she starts to turn her briefly, but says she'll give her, you know, if Triton can exchange his life for hers, which mm-hmm. obviously, you know, he does. And, you know, that scene of him turning into that polyp is just really, you know, just nuts to see. And then, you know, she takes control, and, you know, and then eventually, you know, Eric tries to, you know, help, because, you know, the shell got destroyed, he got freed from his brainwashing. So he then recognized, you know, Ariel for who she was, and at one point Grimsby like asks him, like, what are you doing? He says, you know, I'm not losing her again. And, you know, he tries, you know, like I said, he tries to help, and Flotsam and Jetsam get involved. And then Flounder and Sebastian get involved. And at one point, you know, Ursula tries to kill Eric, but Ariel diverts her aim and she kills Flotsam and Jetsam by mistake, much to her chagrin. And then that kind of leads to, like you said, when she grows into this, you know, this giant, and just that visual of her growing out of the sea is just such a scary sight.
Yeah, it's different and very odd too, because until now, like, she's got plenty of magical power, or you would think, without having to do that. So Andy, where are you at with all this, like, escaping all these blasts and her getting ginormous, and we've lost Flotsam and Jetsam, which that's usually what happens to henchmen and Disney. But where are you at with all this?
My babies, my poopsies, she says. I love the scene where the shell gets broken, and you just see the voice coming back to Ariel. I'm not going to do it because I can't hold that note. But then you just see Eric just realizing that Ariel's the one, always been the one. But then the whole transformation stuff happens, and I think that's kind of terrifying watching after Ursula transforms back into herself, where she's crawling on the thing and grabs Ariel, and the way they frame the shot, I'm out of here. I'm out. This is a little much for me, man. But, you know, Triton having to, give up for his daughter, and yes, Ursula growing huge, ginormous. I think she gets, because in addition to her magic, she takes over Triton's magic. Which that leads her to become this ginormous thing. And yeah, everybody gets a moment to get a little hero shine here with the action. So it's one of the more fun climaxes, I think, in terms of the movies, where the villain just is like, just screw it, and they go for broke, and they think they won, but they don't. You know, and there's a couple of things that remind me, you know, we'll let you read the final moments of the battle, and then I'll tell you what it reminds me of, because, you know me, I always have those analogies.
Okay. So, of course, as Ursula kind of is preparing to destroy Ariel with her Trident Blast, which my thought process is that maybe she doesn't truly know how to work this. Like, you just took this magic over, so it's going to be like Ariel with her legs. You ain't going to get it that quick. But Eric saves Ariel and kills Ursula by ramming a splintered bow spirit toward the witch's abdomen. And what I have in here is it says Ursula dies by blowing up into a scattered mass of organs. And I went, okay. Well, that's disgusting. But anyway, so now Ariel is safe from harm, even if that is what happened. And Eric makes it to shore, and he passes out on the beach, which I would too. I'd be like, did I really just go through all of that? Did I really just stab a giant octopus lady who was pretending to be my love. And oh, by the way, is my love a mermaid? Did I just see that? There's a lot going on here. I would black out as well. So there's that. But he passes out, and after Ursula is murdered and her remains kind of sink to the ocean floor, it removes the curse from the merfolk that are in her garden. So the polyps, as they keep calling them, as well as King Triton, are at peace again and are restored to the ocean. And he obviously gets his crown and his trident and his kingdom back. So tell me what it is that you thought, Andy.
I, as adult, you know, you get these, you know, analogies in your head, and they basically kill her the same way they kill the shark in Jaws the Revenge. Impales her with the ship, and you just see her kind of explode kind of thing, and Ursula bits and guts go all over the place. And then her tentacles are all over the ship, kind of like how the Kraken in the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie, how it takes down ships. So I think there's a lot of sea tales here. But they also, I think, may have been watching some other movies, or people in later on watch this for some reference. I love the ending of this movie, though. It's so sweet. You know, after we get the mm-hmm. terrifying, you know, sea battle and all that. Yes, I would pass out on the beach too. And then Triton just, you know, comes to his senses, you know, realizes that he loves his daughter and just wants her to be happy. And he grants her wish. And, you know, she gets to live happily ever after, which is yeah. how every Disney movie should end.
They, and that's at most I can think of. They all do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he grants her wish after talking to Sebastian, of course. And Sebastian somehow is on her side now. And he says, you know, he will miss her, but he transforms her into a human. And then you're like, wait, you could have done this whole time. Ugh, you're such an overbearing parent, but whatever. So Eric turns to Ariel and basically says, will you marry me? And they finally do kiss. And they are immediately wed shortly after, which I am wondering about all of the wedding party and goers at this point. Are they not like, did that just happen? Did we just watch him walk down the aisle to another woman who then got stabbed and blown up into massive pieces because she was actually an octopus, and now he's marrying this woman instead? Okay. Good party. Good party. Wonderful party. Cake is divine. Coming again. Do you have another sibling? Is he going to do this too? We'll be back.
And you get the great Sebastian on the wedding cake on the top tier with the bride and the groom, and that's where Louis gets one more crack at Sebastian, so to speak. Yep.
One more crack, which I think there are gonna be a lot more cracks at Sebastian since she's going to live in the castle as the princess now. Which she actually is already a princess because her dad is a king, but Ariel bids her friends and family, including her six older sisters, our father Triton, Sebastian, Flounder, and Scuttle, goodbye to live her new life in Eric's world. And the film, of course, ends with Eric and Ariel kissing, and the screen fades to black. So Andy told us a little bit about how he feels about the end of the movie here. So Steve, tell us how you feel. By the way, my jaw kind of hit the floor when he said it was killing from Jaws. Didn't think about that at all. So tell us how you feel about Ursula's demise and the very adorable fade to black kiss that we get, that all of our hearts are finally like, heck yeah, that's what we needed.
That was a pretty intense scene there. You know, Eric mm-hmm. taking that ship and basically skewering Ursula with it. I mean, you get, you know, just like you see, he jams it through her and you actually see it come out the other side of her. It's like, holy crap.
Yeah.
When would you see that in a Disney film? That's
right. He didn't stab her. He impaled her.
Right. And yeah, then she fades away, and like all you see like all these like bits and pieces of her. And then, like mm-hmm. I said, all the polyps return to being, mer people, and, you know, King and Triton's restored. And then, you know, he kind of realizes that, you know, Ariel belongs on the land and not, you know, belongs with the man she loves. And, you know, then eventually, like you said, turns her into a human. And again, you talk about like all the that stuff against that. It's Disney logic. That's basically how you gotta look at it. And I Andy said, yeah, Sebastian and Louis get one more little chase in. And I'll tell you, considering Louis took that that mask like full force of the face, the fact that he only lost a few teeth And that was like the worst of his injuries. I mean, that's like Concussion City right there with that, after getting hit with that. And, so, you know, Sebastian once again gets the better of him, but, yeah, it was definitely a nice end to the film, considering of everything that, that Ariel and Eric had been through. You know, they finally get their happily ever after. And, you know, we get a good ending to this film.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So to get more technical into a few of the things that we usually tell you about the movie, Little Mermaid is the last Disney feature film to use the traditional hand-painted cell method of animation. Our next film that we'll be discussing next month with you guys, Whiskers Down Under, actually also used a digital method of coloring and combining scan drawings. So this is where things started to change, as I mentioned earlier in the movie. Of course, we would not be amiss if we didn't talk about the soundtrack one more time. So the film actually contains 10 songs total, including 3 reprises with the lyrics by Howard and Alan there, who were fantastic at their job at this. A soundtrack was released October 13th of 1989. And was met with wonderful praise. It got some great accolades as well. And it was re-released in 2006. The reception of the movie overall had great reviews upon its initial release, and it actually became known as a cultural phenomenon. Many critics kind of like being like, this is the return to quality filmmaking that we thought Disney was known for. They said, you know, this is going all the way back as wonderful as Snow White and Cinderella. It also won the movie itself, not just the soundtrack, a number of accolades, obviously specifically for music, but it also did, I think they had Academy Award for Best Song and Best Score, 2 Golden Globes and 1 Grammy. Rotten Tomatoes has actually reported this film at 93%. We all know Rotten Tomatoes can be really horrible to movies sometimes. And they actually have this one still listed at 93% certified fresh, which is funny, is it's only actually based on 69 reviews. It has an average rating of 8.19 out of 10, and it became the 9th highest grossing film of 1989, just behind Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Batman, Back to the Future Part 2, Ghostbusters 2, Indiana Jones, and Last Crusade. So that is a heavy list of movies to be up against, to still come in pretty strongly being in the top 10 there. So overall thoughts of the movie, the musical score, how it was received, where does this all fall for you, Andy? In our current lineup, where would you rank this, and how does all of this kind of play into your overall outlook of the movie?
Overall, it's up there in the top echelon of where we at so far. Obviously we don't do rankings really, it is a go-to, it is a favorite, it is a fun movie, has all the great, you know, elements, the fun soundtrack, the great cast, especially, you know, this also, like I've said on a few other times, that it having a daughter who grew up watching it a lot, and seeing it, and also, you know, we also like to talk about the presence they have in parks, the Disney parks, and I have a lot of fond memories of that. Now, Little Mermaid, it took a little while though for them to get into the parks in terms of rides and attractions. When we went to Disney in 2006, Jessica was almost 4. We did go to the Voyage of the Little Mermaid, which was at Disney Hollywood Studios. I think it's closed or it's closing. It's a fun, like, puppet show with black lights where they have the performers behind, like, a black screen where you don't see them. And they perform with all the with the puppets, like, kind of very brightly colored. And Jessica did get to meet Ariel, Little Mermaid, at the Princess Storybook Dining at Akershus in Norway. Okay. She Ariel was not one of the walk-around characters, but actually the first one you meet as you walk in, and you could take a picture. So I do have pictures of little Jessica with her. Also, it's, you know, all over the place. You can meet her at Ariel's Grotto on both sides of the both coasts. as well as they have there's representation in Mickey's PhilharMagic, the Festival of Fantasy Parade, Fantasmic. You could see Ariel and other characters throughout some of the resorts. There's actually a Little Mermaid section at Disney's Art of Animation, which is one of the economy resorts you could stay at. So you could actually, if you have a little girl, you could say, I want to stay in the Little Mermaid section, and you can. There's Sebastian's Bistro, which I've never eaten at, which I would love to. That's at the Caribbean Beach Resort. Mm-hmm. And I did enjoy this ride back in 2018, Under the Sea, The Journey of the Little Mermaid, which was part of the Fantasyland kind of a refresh and expansion.
Florida
is a fun ride. It is you get to go in a clam mobile, a clam, basically a clamshell. Yeah. And it's a omni mover, which means that, it's always moving and you get on the thing. And actually I gotta say, I have an aunt who's special needs, and this is one of the more vivid memories of that trip was when, how great they were. They slowed down the omni mover, how they got her into the moving vehicle. It was so great. Yeah. And it's wonderful. Like a lot of these rides tell the story, like a very Reader's Digest way of telling the story. And this is a lot of fun. I highly, highly recommend this. This movie for me, I guess, gets a little bonus points for having a daughter again that loves it. So, but I love it on its own. Before she came around, I did like this movie a lot.
Okay. Steve, where are your final thoughts on this movie, and how do you feel about it overall?
Oh, it's definitely up there as one of the best films, at least to this point, it's definitely easily one of the best. I mean, it's like you said, ranks up there with like Snow White and Sleeping Beauty. And I think it was definitely a good return to form for Disney, because as we talked about, the 80s have been a very up and down time for them. We kind of started rocky with the Fox and the Hound and Black Cauldron, and then we kind of started ticking up a bit with Great Mouse Detective and Oliver and Company. But I think there was still some question as to whether they still had it in them to make classic films that rivaled some of their earlier ones, mm-hmm. Especially since they were also dealing with competition from, Don Bluth. And I think with this film, it kind of showed people that, they still had it, and that they, that this was going to be the start of what was going to be a very, lucrative period for them. And it's definitely, it's one that if you haven't seen in a while, you should definitely watch. And I think you'll kind of realize that this is a great film, and definitely one of the best that they've done. Just no question about it.
I would agree. I think Disney was set up for needing a refresh and a reset. Even though you and I were huge fans of Great Mouse Detective, there's not many of us in the world, I feel like, but we were very huge fans of that. And we felt like that was where it was kind of starting to pick back up. But I think, unfortunately, the truth is that Little Mermaid was the refresh, the reset for Disney to show that they were still in the game. Overall, this is one of my top Disney movies. Still not my favorite, but it is in the top. It overall has a fantastic score that most everyone recognizes. It's a story that you can follow. It's not boring. It's rewatchable and works very well. So I enjoyed being able to rewatch and discuss this with you guys. Before we leave, we'll just take like we normally do, and I'll have each of you tell me where they can be found. But first I want to tell everybody, Steve is very humble and he's mentioned it a couple of times, but there are some amazing articles on our Place to Be Nation website where he has ranked, the songs. You have written reviews for most all of the movies. I think are we finally caught up to where you were, or did you end up going all the way through them? I can't remember.
Well, it's actually funny you mentioned that, because this month I will actually be reviving the wonderful reviews of Disney, as I will review Raya and the Last Dragon, which came out about a year ago. So
fantastic.
That will be updated to the site, and that will be up to speed. I probably won't do Encanto until later in the year, kind of get to the year anniversary for that. Yeah. So
Yeah, but you can check all those out. You even did some rankings on the princes, if I remember correctly. So he's being very humble about it, but there's a lot of great information that if you are listening to us because you're a Disney fan, I highly recommend you go checking out. Of course, check out any of the other articles over there as well. Steve, since I already kind of have you talking, tell everybody where they can find you on the Interweavals, where you're comfortable with them finding you.
Well, in addition to this show, of course, I also serve as the host and moderator of Mickey Mount Rushmore on here on the Pop Feed. We have a lot of fun with that. And usually you can find me over on the Place to Be Facebook page. Lots of great stuff going on over there, discussions, occasional tournaments, and just a great place for everyone to come together and just talk random stuff. And that's pretty much it. And so, yeah, check out everything on this feed and on all our other feeds across the Quadapods.
There's a lot going on our whole Quadapods here. But of course, we wouldn't be anywhere without our illustrious leader. So, Andy, tell everyone where you are comfortable with them finding you as well. This great, lovely host of things.
You can find me on Facebook. I have a Twitter. I have an Instagram. I really don't post on either because I'm kind of old and lazy. So, here at Placement Nation on the Pop Experience, lots of great shows. Check them out, dropping all the time. Weekly is Pop Goes to the Couch. That's myself, Tim Capel, Scott Shiflett, Sean Kidd. We review the whatever the current streaming shows are, whether it's Cobra Kai, Hawkeye, Peacemaker, whatever's current. I believe this is dropping in the month of March, so I'm not sure what we'll be covering at the moment in time that this very show drops. Check out all the great shows, though. I also do Laughing Theater, Blockbuster Rewatch. Both of those are done as pods. And sometimes I do them on Stream Lounge first and then turn them into pods later. So check me out over there on the Stream Lounge. You know, Pop will be back by the time you hear this. My new show, Cartoons of Our Youth, should have dropped at least one episode by now. And, check out the Placement Nation Wrestling Network. Lots of great wrestling content. I do appear over there sometimes with Evolution. I am actually part of the PTBN Pedestal crew. I have yet to make my debut, but that should be coming soon. If not, have by the time you hear this. Also check out the North-South Connection, the great mix of sports, pop culture, and wrestling, and Miranda's Besties feed, The Jenny's Position, where you can hear lots of great shows. So, yeah, check out everybody. Go to the website, placemation.com. Check out the Place to Be group on Facebook. If you're not part of it, come join us. We have lots of fun, lots of great discussion. And like Steve mentioned, we have tournaments. There should be one going by the time this drops. So check it out.
Absolutely. And I'm a little like Andy in the sense that I have a Twitter, and I have seen that people have messaged me on Twitter. I apologize. I am bad at the Twitter. But you can find me over on Instagram as well as the TikTok. I have learned it. Yes, I have. I don't do crazy dances, so don't come expecting that. It ain't happening. But you can find me on both of those at Moms and Nerd. Of course, I am in the Facebook group, and we'll speak to you there just like both of my lovely co-hosts do. There's a lot on the website and in the group. Just to reiterate what both of them said, they're both very humble and they do excellent work, and you should listen to all the podcasts that they are part of. We have such a great feed here, and a whole group of family and all the other feeds. There's literally something for everyone. Be sure to check everything out. And for myself, Andy, and Steve, we will see you next time when we go down under.